Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
Our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And joining us in studio again, we have our TV critic, Sonia Soraya.
Hey.
Sonia, we brought you in here because it is kind of a quiet time for movies out there. There's like a couple things of interest. There's just the Avengers looming in the horizon, but it's a really busy time for television. There's so much stuff premiering in the next couple weeks, partly because of Emmy qualification, which we can get into. So basically, I needed help like shoveling through the pile of prestige shows that are debuting. I don't know if, as a person who has to watch all of these, if you feel like you're just buried under a giant pile right now.
Buried, which sounds like Barry, a sitcom on HBO. I do a little bit, but I think also, as we'll talk about, there's like a cream of the crop that like becomes really apparent.
As in, there's a whole lot of stuff out there, but only a handful of things you actually need to pay attention to?
Yeah, kind of. Although things are a little different this year because of the way HBO has changed its strategy. There's just like so many more HBO shows in contention for the Emmys this year than there typically are. But yeah, I feel like it makes it possible to focus on stuff, but it comes at the expense of everything else.
So what are you focusing on? You brought up Barry. Is that top of mind for you right now?
I like love Barry. I watched the second season, the first three episodes of the second season, and I felt like really on the hook for it. Killing Eve obviously like was excited for season two, and then I saw the first two episodes and it like blew me away. And Fosse Verdon on FX, the Bob Fosse miniseries.
The television event of the century? That's
basically the television event of the century. It's so much fun. It's so much fun to, like, have dancing, like, sexy musical theater dancing. It feels like there's a lot of fun stuff this year to talk about.
Richard and Joanna, you guys have been over at Still Watching, like, very, very deep in Game of Thrones world. So when new stuff comes out that isn't about, like, killing and fur pelts, like, does it feel like a relief?
Well, I mean, Fosse Verdon is kind of about killing and fur pelts, but definitely. You know, it's fun to just kind of pick your head up. And, you know, I've also been so, you know, in movie land all Oscar season and then kind of the residual after. It's nice to kind of tuck into something that's, you know, many hours long and really interesting. I agree with Sonia. The Barry is great. I'm really liking Fosse Verdon and, you know, Veep is as good as ever. So there's exciting stuff. For me, I'm not necessarily writing about everything, but as a just casual viewer, it's a good time to be a TV watcher.
Joanna, what are you excited about that isn't Thrones related?
Yeah, I mean, I thought The Return of Veep was really, really good. And I did this interview with Dave Mandel at TCA, the showrunner of Veep, and he was talking to me a lot about how the luxury they have of doing this political comedy is the fact that in their reality, Trump doesn't exist. And so it's like he called it a Trump-free zone. And I was just like, yes. And that's a huge relief because, like, as much as, you think we're, you know, occupied with talking about Game of Thrones. I feel like we've all been like hooked on the Trump show for 2 years with like a massive hangover. And the fact that Veep comes along after a longish absence because of Julia Louis-Dreyfus's health, and we kind of forgot what political comedy was without like the Trump shadow over it. And of course the Trump shadow is there. And of course it is reacting in some ways to the Trump administration, but it's nice, you know, it's nice not to be on that like SNL, let's just regurgitate what Trump is saying sort of cycle, and to have something a little more broader and that will be more resonant once this is all over, if that makes sense.
So this is one of the things that like I feel like I got off of Veep a little bit because of the whole Trump factor of it. Like, I don't know if I wanted to watch political stuff at all in like my precious leisure time. Like, I mean, Veep has always been kind of like biting in addition to being funny. Like, how's that balance working these days, especially with their last season coming up? Like, I wondered if they would suddenly start getting sentimental as they wrap up these characters.
They are not getting sentimental as they wrap up these characters.
I think that last season did end on like a surprisingly emotional note for the Selena character, because she had, you know, she makes this awful in everyone's mind decision to run for president again, and had to sort of put aside the actually kind of nice life that she had built for herself outside of office. And the idea was like she couldn't let herself have this nice thing because she's just is who she is, and she's a political creature and she needs to be in the mix of it. And sort of, so what you're watching her do now is this slow motion bad life decision, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's softened, but there is that sort of emotional resonance that hangs over it more than just some of the antics that we've seen in season past.
And I think also, you know, aside from Trump, what we can kind of look at it now as like it's some weird distorted reflection of the Democratic primary scramble that's happening right now.
This is what I was just thinking.
And I hope to hell that that's not actually what's happening behind the scenes with all these people who are kind of relying on to rescue the world. But it is still grimly funny to just watch everyone be so petty. And because the show, I mentioned this, I reviewed the first three episodes of the new season. The show has really never been about policy. You know, it's not a show that's kind of mocking grander political ideals. It's much more petty and small than that. And so I think because of that, you can kind of infer stuff that, you know, connections to the real world, but you can also just like wade into something that I think I called like, it's kind of like a weird meta competency porn. It's not like watching people good at their jobs. It's watching people who are really good at playing people who are terrible at their jobs. And there's just something really satisfying about the cast just clicking so well. I believe we'll have an interview with Anna Chlumsky coming up soon on this podcast, by the way.
Good tease.
And the other thing about Veep that Dave Mandel pointed out and is true is like when that show started, it was so sort of wickedly delicious for us because we're like, ooh, this is a backstage glimpse. Oh, we can't believe people actually say this stuff. They behave so badly. This is amazing. And he's like, the backstage, though, now is gone in American politics, right? We see the backstage all the time. We see it tweeted out like every day. So that same degree of like, ooh, I can't believe people are actually this awful is like not in our mindset anymore. And so there has to be something else. And I think there is. I think there's plenty else there.
I think that the joy I get from Veep is that they're all terrible people, but what they do, which is like bad for America, like arguably, but it seems all really bad for America, but like they don't seem happy by it. Like they are actively making themselves miserable. Like sort of like you were saying, Joanna, like Selena leaves this life that is nice. Like she has a grandchild that she like refuses to appreciate, like, or acknowledge or anything. Like it's just a prop. It all serves this like political theater that is like vicious and terrible. So that like is comforting to me. I like to think about, Donald Trump being miserable. So.
You're not the only one. So
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
you know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Talking about Barry, which also is the half-hour comedy airing on HBO right now, I kind of had the opposite concern about its second season as Veep, where, like, it felt like the end of season one of Barry, which I loved, like, really got dark. Like, it got darker and darker as the season went on and kind of watching this character, like, grapple with his demons. And I was curious about how it would spring back into comedy, potentially, at the beginning of this season. I mean, they still have Henry Winkler, so it can't be so bad. But anyway, how do they pull that off?
I think that it's partly due to, like, Barry's own complete denial about everything, that, like, they just, like, the gulf between the way he wants things to be and the way things actually are is so wide that it is, I mean, it is very funny. Like, the whole first episode, their acting class is supposed to put on, oh my God, the front page, that comedy, the front page. And so for the whole episode, Barry, who has killed a person at the end of the first season.
His acting teacher's girlfriend.
Who is the police detective who's investigating him. Okay, so he's literally killed this person, but is like in this old timey, like 40s, like newspaper outfit with like a press thing in his fedora and is like practicing these like ridiculous hokey lines. It really worked for me. I was like, this is delusion. This is delusional.
Yeah, it's a dark show for sure. But I think that what the first season does fascinatingly and the second season continues on is, as the first season goes, the show kind of tells you, oh, did you think that he was like the hero of the story? Like, he's a terrible person and probably a sociopath. And so the second season kind of like reminds you of that. And then everyone's in this kind of depression / kind of panic. And it's really more the whole circumstances of the show, even though the characters within it are taking it very seriously. So it's a really tricky line to walk, and you know, it's one I think that Weeds tried to do and failed a lot, and succeeded other times. And there's some quirky stuff in Barry that I think works maybe only three quarters of the time, but it's still a fascinating show, and Bill Hader's great. Anthony Carrigan is great as a kind of bizarre gangster. Stephen Root is excellent as Barry's sort of former hitman boss. And Winkler obviously is wonderful. I mean, everyone's good. It's just like a really compelling and dark show. I don't know how many seasons this kind of tension can be sustained for, but for now, the second season is surprisingly working well.
Sarah Goldberg, who plays Sally, who is Barry's girlfriend, has a lot more to do in this season. And
Good. That was a problem I had with the first one.
Yeah, the whole joke of the first season is that she's so self-obsessed that she can't pick up on all the red flags around this person. And like that kind of keeps escalating for part of season two. But then you just begin to explore her character more and sort of realize, again, the delusion, but this time the delusion of someone who, like, leaves their whole life behind them to go to Hollywood and pursue this acting career, and, like, the kind of narcissism that fuels that, but also, like, where that might come from. I really thought, like, just in one episode, in the third episode, I just saw her change so much, and it was like, oh, there's so much more to this performance than I had originally anticipated. So it's kind of fun to see those dimensions, too.
Richard, you talked about not knowing how far Barry could go with the premise that it has. And I feel like that was something brought up a lot about Killing Eve, which had its like blockbuster first season last year. And I think many people, there's been pieces written about it and then just generally on Twitter, like maybe it should have just been one season. But it's back and I'm really excited to see what everyone is wearing. But I'm curious if the premise manages to sustain itself for an entire second season of this. Who's seen it? Sonia's seen it.
I have seen it, yeah.
Well, I actually kind of made a choice that I've made with some other shows, is I'm not going to watch it because I think the first season for me was so perfect that I'm not going to watch a second season of Fleabag. And it's not that I'm just abandoning British shows about women, I promise.
From Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
No, I'm going to push back on the Fleabag thing. We'll get to that more.
We'll get to Fleabag.
Like, But
and I probably will get to them at some point. But I just, for right now, I'm just sort of like still savoring the first seasons. And I've had many shows kind of sour in my estimation of them in the second season. So I'm sort of experimenting and seeing, can my love of a first season be sustained even while people are watching more and more new episodes? And I don't know. So far, it's okay. But maybe I'll come to regret
but it. But hasn't premiered yet.
I'll say this. So I've seen both. Like, I've seen a few episodes of the new season of Killing Eve. And I will just say this, that like, I don't dislike it. I like it. I do agree with the takes that like, okay, the first season had this element of surprise, or like, you know, we had never seen Jodie Comer do what she does in this show. We had seen Sandra Oh be great and other things, obviously. You know, so I think it has a high bar to clear in order to like match what the first season did for us. And I'm not sure it quite clears that. With Fleabag, which we'll get to, I think it sails right over that bar and into like the stratosphere. So I think you're right to be cautious, Richard. And I am curious what Sonia thinks of Killing Eve season two.
I mean, I only saw, you know, they only sent out two episodes, and I really, like in this case, I really wish I could have seen more because it's so hard. I mean, the first two episodes of Killing Eve, the first season, weren't a very good indication, I think, of what that season was going to be. But I was not sure if it was going to pull off. I mean, I feel skeptical about season twos, especially ones that like feel rushed to capitalize on some buzz. But I really liked where it went. I mean, I'm trying to think if I can describe it in any way. Basically, there were a couple of set pieces that like a whole one of the ways that Villanelle tries to survive after, like, there's multiple ways, like after what happens in the finale, like, so Sandra Oh like stabs her, Eve stabs her, right, and then she like staggers out, and like you see her surviving, and the way she survives is just so, to me, it was so illustrative and so. It really capitalized on Villanelle's whole thing of being like the charming, feminine, teenage girlish type, but then also like being really deadly on the other side. And it was really fun to see her in the position of being being desperate, being helpless. As even when she was in the prison, Villanelle was really scary the whole time. But this really feels like she's been knocked out of her comfort zone. And then Sandra Oh, as Eve, is doing this whole like guilt thing because she feels like she can't talk about what she did with Villanelle. She wasn't supposed to go to Paris in the first place. And then like her doing that like really messes her up. I mean, at least at first. And I just liked seeing Sandra Oh do that. So I feel optimistic, but I definitely, you know, I don't know what's going to happen.
You know what? So Fleabag doesn't premiere until May, but Joanna, you brought it up as something that sails the bar for the first season to second season. So we'll talk about Fleabag more later when it's closer to premiering, but give us a tease about Fleabag.
Well, I mean, I think it's worth talking about the fact that Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who also wrote and co-created, adapted Killing Eve, the first season at least. She's not the writer on the second season. That I think she doesn't approach these things without that heavy skepticism that Richard talks about, because she has said publicly and loudly that this second season of Fleabag is her putting this character to bed forever. That she, you know, this is a character that she did on stage before, you know, she did any TV. This is a character that she has like performed at like the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And then I believe she's currently doing it in New York, or is about to, or just finished doing it. Anyway, she's doing a little run of the original Fleabag show on the stage in New York. And so she's like, she's done it. And she's like, okay, I have this idea for how to like put Fleabag to bed, and then I'm done with that. This is the thing that launched my career, and then I want to move on and do something else. And I think that intentionality is really, really clear in the second season, which just sort of takes what's so great about the first season and then breaks it in a way that is really emotionally true to the character, and I will be as vague as possible. And the other thing that it benefits from, and we'll talk about this more when we get closer to when it actually airs, is Andrew Scott is brought in as sort of like, there's a lot of great people in the second season. Fiona Shaw from Killing Eve in the second season, Kristen Scott Thomas is in the second season, blah, blah, blah. But Andrew Scott is brought in, you know, that people might know as Moriarty from the Sherlock, the Benedict Cumberbatch Sherlock, is brought in to be this like foil to her. And he's just like a live wire. He's perfect. And so it's just, it's a short season. I think it's probably what, 6 episodes, maybe 8. And I think it is just like a very intentional, planned goodbye. And I feel like we need more of that, just sort of like intentional, contained storytelling in the era of peak TV when we're just constantly like inundated by things that outstay their welcome.
Are you saying that a certain series that's airing its final season soon may not have planned things so intentionally?
No, it is. I mean, well, that is just like trying desperately to wrap up a saga that is so long in the making. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's a different kind of wrap
up. Sure, yeah. Game of Thrones is much more unwieldy than Fleabag.
Yeah, you couldn't have wrapped that up in season 5. You know what I mean? So, like, I think they're doing, I think, in fact, their attempts to get it done is, you know, and Richard and I have talked about this on the Still Watching Game of Thrones Rewatch podcast that we're doing, their attempts to get it done in any reasonable timeline is what has prompted some of the, like, I don't know, broader strokes storytelling that they're doing in the later seasons of Game of Thrones.
Sonia, I wanted to go back. You mentioned something about like a new strategy that HBO is employing, and they have more shows in the running. Can you kind of unpack that just a little bit, or is there something to unpack there?
I think that the only thing to unpack there is that it seems as if HBO has ramped up its distribution schedule. I'm saying that as without really, based on the fact that, you know, they changed ownership. It's now run by AT&T. They have a new, the new head and Bob Greenblatt. Based on the information that came out of whatever that strategy shift was, There was this rumor, you know, early in the year that HBO was going to be more like Netflix, and I don't know if that's exactly true, but it does seem true that there are so many HBO shows that are debuting just this spring alone, on top of what was already in contention, that you could fill out like every Emmy category, nearly every Emmy category, with just really good HBO contenders that are all going to be competing against each other. And I just think that there's something interesting and a little overwhelming about it, because as someone who likes all of these shows, having them all stacked on top of each other makes it hard to pick out one or two to be like, you know, these are the winners, these are the ones that we should focus on, when it feels like a lot of really good things are going to be in contention. So, like, for example, like, you know, my brilliant friend, which was the Elena Ferrante adaptation, I think would have been like a more serious contender for awards in a different year. But
I forgot that it happened.
Literally has like fall. Yeah, exactly. Like they built that entire town on a soundstage. Like it's crazy how much they did. It was a foreign language show. I mean, completely cast in Naples. They spent so much time and money on it. And it's just one of like 15 to 20 shows that is that HBO is putting out, like, you know, Leaving Neverland, which is like the documentary side of things, is also in contention. I mean, it's sort of wild. I mean, like Sharp Objects is eligible for this Emmy round, which is, you know, from last summer.
Insane. It feels insane. Yeah.
Another one that's coming out soon. So, I mean, of course, there's Game of Thrones. There's Succession, which was this summer. That's also in contention. Sharp Objects, Veep, Barry. Didn't Silicon Valley happen this year, too? And then I feel like there's so many documentary stuff that is even a little bit outside of my radar, but there was Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos and Leaving Neverland about Michael Jackson, Case Against Adnan Syed. Like, these are sort of, you know, major contenders. And then there's even more things that are still coming out. So not just Game of Thrones, but also, I guess, like Insecure, I'm expecting to come out fairly soon. And Gentleman Jack, which is...
oh, yeah.
What is that?
With Sally Wainwright.
Sally Wainwright.
So this is like a Sally Wainwright who did Happy Valley. This is one of her passion projects that she's been working on apparently for like a decade. And it's like a period piece about lesbians, which is amazing.
It's so my jam. And it's based on a true figure.
Which is so cool. Ugh. I mean, and on top of High Maintenance, which I know is like me and Richard both love that show. Like, how are all of these shows can flesh out an entire, like, the half hour? I'm like, that could all be HBO shows, and I would have a really hard time deciding which one.
Wait, the Deadwood movie is also still coming with an eligibility?
Actually, I think it is. I think it is.
I'm just looking at Gold Derby and like looking at the HBO stuff. Yeah. That is bananas.
So it's bananas. It's bananas how much is coming out in just a few months and how much is all going to be in contention at the same time.
And I mean, they exactly what Sonia is saying, they have been plain spoken. The new regime at HBO has said, like, okay, it's we've been known for quality all these years. Now we're going to be known for quantity as well. And I think there's this fear that, like, you know, the HBO, if HBO puts its logo on something, right, you're like, okay, I know what that means. That means a certain level of prestige, whatever, versus Netflix is throwing anything at the wall to see what sticks. Like, the Netflix logo on something means nothing to me because it could be Richard's favorite show, Fuller House, or it could be, you know, Russian Doll. You don't know what you're gonna get. With HBO, there was like this certain like sheen of like, you know, prestige to it that I think they're just less concerned with because they're chasing the Netflix model. And I think you've heard this from people who both love HBO or have worked at HBO, is that they're really worried, not even just what it looks like now, which as Sonia outlined is like already bananas, but what it's going to look like. Because like, bear in mind that HBO just really puts almost 100% of their original program is just on Sunday nights, right? Like occasionally part two will be on Monday, but that's been HBO. Is like, we do something on Sunday. It's going to be great.
It's why you work on Sundays, Joanna.
Yeah. And it's why I haven't had a Sunday off in like 5 years, you know what I mean? And so like, but now they're like, what if we do programming on other nights? And I think all of us, you know, Sonia maybe included, because she diligently watches more television than all of us, like, are crying in anticipation of trying to keep up with like everything that they have planned. They're not alone in this sort of like chase the Netflix model of flood the market. But I just, because every network, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my understanding, HBO needs, as we move increasingly to like these streamer options for how we watch things, HBO increasingly needs to make you feel like HBO Go, the app HBO Go, is essential to mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. And if you can only pick one, it has to be HBO Go. And they felt assured of that for the last however many years, because they had Game of Thrones. Even if Game of Thrones was gone a year, you like maybe didn't drop your HBO subscription because Game of Thrones is coming back and this is the biggest show in the world. But that is about to end, and you can talk to me all day long about spinoffs, but like HBO is sweating and worried about their primacy without Game of Thrones. And so the answer seems to be
flood the zone.
More stuff.
What feels good right now, at least with regards to this strategy, is that the shows all still feel good. Like, all of these things are coming out on top of each other, but I still feel good about, like, Barry's great, Veep's great, Brilliant, My Brilliant Friend is great, Succession, Sharp Objects, all, like, high quality. But I don't know if they can continue that with the pace being so elevated, which I think is, like, their big challenge right now.
I'm really struck by the difference between Oscar strategies and Emmy strategies, where like HBO, clearly they want to be Netflix, they want to compete on volume, but they care about Emmys. Like, they need the prestige to keep all of this going. And the idea of like, you know, if you were Focus Features and you were just throwing 100 things at the wall to hope one of them would stick for an Oscar, that would never work. But the way I think Netflix has really changed this formula of TV, where like you have to prove that you're gigantic, like Joanna was saying, you have to have your app be on there. And then hopefully you can also spend enough money to get something in there that works prestige-wise. But I wonder how sustainable that is. Like, Netflix has endless VC money. I don't know that HBO does. They have AT&T, I guess. But, you know, they're not going to just spend forever on the Deadwood movie.
Have you guys noticed that when you watch anything on, like, a streaming service, if there's ads, so many of the ads are for other things to watch? I don't know if this is happening to other people.
Like, other things to watch on that service?
Or on different services. Like, if I watch, like if I'm watching something on Comedy Central's app, I'll get advertisements for, like, Hulu shows or sometimes NBC shows, or other things on Comedy Central. Yeah, that's true too. Or HBO, I get advertised a lot of, like, they're like, oh, you're in this niche, like, here's more. which I think speaks, Joanna, to a sort of what you were saying, this like flooding the zone thing where it's like, oh, like subscribe to this. Like it has this thing that you like, just reminding you we exist.
Yeah, exactly. You need us. You don't remember that you need us. Actually, the worst version of this, and I don't know if this happens. Maybe it's just like my cable provider Xfinity does this. I don't know. But if you're catching up on a show that you've fallen behind on and you're watching old episodes and then they give you like an ad for an episode that's like way down the line, you're like, wait, why are you showing me? No. Come
like
on,
the spoilers.
I'm trying to catch
right,
up.
Right.
Yeah, the spoilers. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I wanted to talk about one other show that is not on HBO or Netflix, and maybe we can talk about what that means. FX is coming out with their big Fosse Verdon miniseries. We've talked about FX a lot in the past for kind of its historical things with People vs. O.J. Simpson and the American Crime Story last year. Those are all under the Ryan Murphy umbrella. Ryan Murphy has gone over to Netflix at this point. The existence of Fosse Verdon say anything about FX's strategy other than that they want to stick with this? Like, is this their kind of big post-Ryan Murphy, we don't need him, we can have something splashy on our own statement?
Yeah, I think it's part of that. The interesting thing about watching the show is that, like, you know, as a, you know, theater major, theater nerd kid, I'm like totally enwrapped, even though the show is actually mostly about making movies, but, you know, it's all these kind of theater figures in it. And I think it's, you know, it's really compelling. It's very well acted. But I do have a question, and maybe you agree with me, Sonia, maybe you don't, as to like who it's really for beyond that pretty narrow audience, you know? Like FX weirdly has built up an audience that's sort of like Sons of Anarchy and other kind of tough, gritty shows, but also they have American Horror Story and Pose and the assassination of Johnny Versace. So there's a sort of, I don't know, queerer audience maybe involved. I think Fosse Verdon definitely obviously falls on that side of things. But I'm just curious, like, how big the audience for it is actually going to be, given that it doesn't have the Ryan Murphy imprimatur on it, and yet is sort of in the same vein as some of his past projects for the network.
Yeah, I mean, it does sort of seem to me like they're hoping that they can keep whatever audience came to FX for Ryan Murphy, because to my mind, FX was like a bro kind of network, you know, for like a super long time with like, you know, Justified and Archer, Sons of Anarchy, and like now Mayans, as you said, and like a lot, like It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, like started on FX, like things like that. But then like they definitely began to change, you know, the Americans, which was like super critically lauded and eventually got recognized by the Emmys, was like never really had audience numbers that paid off, but people, like critics, liked it. And so they kind of held on to it. And then while that was happening, you know, Ryan Murphy was establishing this empire, which was like, I think a lot of it did bring like a queer audience. So it sort of seems to me like Fosse Verdon is like, are we a player in this space? Like, can we still do it? And what I like about that is that at least they're giving us a really good show to work with, and maybe that will pay off for them. But it does seem a little bit like a gamble, especially because it is so insidery. I was talking to Hillary Busis, my editor, about Fosse Verdon, and there are a lot of references that I like didn't get when I was watching it, because I'm not, you know, I'm not a theater nerd, theater major, but I still really enjoyed it because it was performances and dancing, and I could follow the plot well enough, and I felt like I was learning something about that era on Broadway, so that was kind of fun. But yeah, I wonder how many more Easter eggs I'm going to miss as I keep going.
What I've seen so far is that it feels like an interesting writing of the record for Gwen Verdon, who's Michelle Williams' character, because like Bob Fosse, like, you know, probably if you don't know much about theater, you still know who, you have a vague idea of who Bob Fosse is, and you can like do a jazz hand and be like, I understand Bob Fosse. With Gwen Verdon, I think you have to go like a couple layers down into knowing about musicals and musical theater. You know, if you've seen the film version of Damn Yankees, she was considered, I think, like, you know, a stage star, but as the show quickly gets into, was maybe not considered like photogenic enough to be a movie star. And the other thing that the show quickly gets into, so I don't think this is a spoiler, is just sort of like how much what Bob Fosse did for work was a collaboration between himself and Gwen Verdon, and how much her legacy just got lost. Mm. And like his own sort of petty, insecure masculinity around the attention that she received at the time. I think that's like it reminds me a lot of The People versus OJ and sort of us looking at Marsha Clark again in a different way. Obviously, like Gwen Verdon was never like vilified the way that Marsha Clark was, but like it's a similar sort of correcting of the record, which I appreciate in all the other musical, you know, because I, you know, Katie and I have been really excited for this show because we're a big musicals fan, and I've been like sending Katie YouTube clips of Fosse stuff, and she's like, I already watched that one.
You've been helping me in my education, though. I'm just one of the people who like has like loved musicals my whole life. I didn't know who Gwen Verdon was. Like, I didn't have that level of research, and like you're saying, it's really easy to overlook her legacy in this stuff.
Yeah. But I'm excited for it. It's so funny because before the show was announced, I spent a couple days with friends like a couple years ago just going down these various YouTube like wormholes of Bob Fosse stuff. And you can do that yourself at home, listener, if you don't know who Bob Fosse is.
YouTube is an amazing resource for this stuff.
I mean, you can watch whole movies, obviously. But like if you don't want to, just want to watch like some of his choices choreography and then go launch from there and watch like what Beyonce took from Bob Fosse, what Michael Jackson took from Bob Fosse, and like how much like, and it's not just like inspired by, its direct moves lifts from, and how much that has impacted like what we think of as dance throughout the years. It's not just like musical theater dance, it's like our culture of dance is so much Fosse in many, many ways. And the Paula Abdul music video, Cold Hearted Snake, which is obviously a classic. So, you know, check out the Fosse legacy.
Be careful, because watching Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon videos on YouTube, that's just a gateway to Jordan Peterson and getting red pilled. You know, that's it's a slippery slope. But yeah, something I really appreciate about the show is that while it does absolutely, you know, give more context for, you know, the brilliant mind that was Gwen Verdon, it doesn't make Fosse this kind of horrible anti-hero, just like nightmare to watch. There are moments where you just want to like push him down a flight of stairs, frankly, because he's just so annoying. But I think it's both the writing and Sam Rockwell's performance. There is at the very least like some the roundedness of a real human there, you know, and I appreciate that because I think a lot of times it can be, you know, I don't tend to like biopics about troubled creative men, because I think a lot of the time you're just watching a real asshole for 2 hours. And this, there are moments where that is true, but I think that there is it's a little more textured than that, which I really appreciate. And I also think, you know, I kind of tweeted about it last night. Actually, I was like, I kind of wish the show was just called Verdon, because Michelle Williams is so good in the role. And it's kind of a weird side cousin to what she was doing in All the Money in the World, but I think it works better here.
In terms of what? Just the performance? Like, because the characters don't seem to have anything in common.
The characters have nothing in common. It's just an affectation of a kind of mid-century kind of voice and bearing, and a sort of, you know, I mean, Verdon's life was not, you know, patrician from the outset, certainly, but like, you know, that kind of maybe slightly affected, wealthy bearing, but it's subtle though. It's really well done, and you know, and Rockwell is good too. But I think I've seen that character before. I've seen a performance like that before. Whereas Williams is doing something that feels new to me.
For what it's worth, something interesting about the production too is that Nicole Fosse, who Bob Fosse and Gwen Verdon's daughter, who's a character as a child, was a creative consultant on the show. She's like doing a little bit of press for them too. So there is a, as you were saying, Richard, like Bob Fosse makes mistakes, but he's not this like monstrous figure either. I think there's a lot of love for both people and for the relationship they had with each other, this really fruitful collaboration. I think you can see a lot of the affection there too.
One last thing that I want to say about Michelle Williams' performance, and I also messaged Katie about this on the side as we were watching, is like she navigates a set of, I believe, I could be wrong, but a set of fake teeth to look a bit more like Gwen Verdon did, and like navigates them beautifully. And I'm just going to like say that maybe this is the set of fake teeth that we should pay attention to this awards year. And then the other thing that I wanted to say is like something that's interesting about the Bob Fosse figure as this like tortured artist, anti-hero, but nuanced that we've seen before. It's fun to see something like this, this kind of like frustrated masculinity in the world of musical theater and dance, because like, you know, that is like the interesting thing about Fosse, is that he has this like machismo thing to him in this world of musical theater that people like think is not reeking with machismo. You know what I mean? And that's just like a kind of fascinating dynamic.
Yeah, someone was tweeting about just like Bob Fosse as someone who would be canceled by a current culture immediately, and all that jazz exists out there as ample evidence of why he would not work in modern society. So I'm curious if this does anything to reframe that legacy. So as we mentioned at the top of the show, one of the reasons that there is this huge glut of good TV right now is that the Emmys eligibility deadline is June 1st. So much like with the Oscars, about how all of the big movies will come out in the fall, so they're fresh in people's minds, a lot of these big shows will come back at the same time and try to really make their case for nominations. Looking at last year's nominees, like Marvelous Mrs. Maisel and Game of Thrones were the big winners last time. They are both back in the running. Just kind of looking at the Emmy race this year as an overall thing, are you guys feeling optimistic about what might get through, kind of resigned to the stuff that's just going to get awarded over and over again? Where do things stand with this next awards race we're going to watch?
Well, I feel like with both Veep and Game of Thrones ending, they're kind of going to eat up a lot of bandwidth, you know? Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of times with the Emmys, like, you know, the triumph is getting the nomination and getting recognized, because there are so many things to be, you know, like, I like in the mix, like, I don't think that, you know, Beloved High Maintenance will get in there. I don't think the other two will get in there, but like, maybe we can hope for that. But yeah, it kind of feels like this is going to be one, like Sonia was saying, dominated by HBO and by those two shows in particular.
Yeah, I think that like, if there was a time for the Emmys to be like, maybe not all Game of Thrones everything, it was last year when Game of Thrones had been gone for like a year and people barely remembered it and stuff like that. And the like, if you look at the win, like the Game of Thrones producers themselves are sort of like, oh really? Okay. You know, or
not
Peter Dinklage.
Crown?
Yeah, Peter Dinklage similarly was like, really? Okay. You know what I mean? Or like, I think the first year they won was the like Mad Men's last year, and they were like, really? Okay. You know, so like, I think we just have to like say, okay, a Game of Thrones sweep. There are some like acting categories that I care about specifically when it comes to Game of Thrones. I think we'll have to like wait and see what this final season give those particular actors.
For the hardest?
Well, like, Lena Headey doesn't have an Emmy for Game of Thrones. Like, Peter Dinklage has all the Emmys for Game of Thrones, and, like, much love to Peter Dinklage, but, like, Lena Headey, Nicola Costa-Waldo, Alfie Allen, that's my, like, outsider, like, hope. So, you know, that's I think, where things could get interesting, because it's always been a little tricky with Game of Thrones because it's an ensemble, you know, of sorts, so it's hard to, like, pluck out a lead, and the people who are the de facto leads now are maybe not their strongest performers. But, I think that that's going to be, as you say, taking up a lot of the space, or it's just like a foregone conclusion. And so then, like, what are the other categories where we're like, okay, maybe there's an actual race here, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys are totally right. Like, drama and comedy, both of those categories are so overpopulated and also are both very likely to be swept by these two shows that are ending that have been beloved by the Emmy voters and by audiences. Limited series might be more of a toss-up. We've got two shows where Patricia Arquette is like doing really good performances that are both going to be eligible to run against each other, which is The Act on Hulu and Escape at Dannemora on Showtime. And then there's also Sharp Objects maybe in the mix there, although that hasn't done any awards at all. It felt for so long that limited series, for several years, it seemed like a limited series was where all the action was happening. But it sort of seems like a lot of new shows have pushed back towards the traditional categories because, you know, Fleabag and Barry are both comedies, and Killing Eve is, you know, classic drama. So I don't know. It's hard to imagine anything else breaking through the unified front of the Veep and Game of Thrones, but certainly a lot of shows are trying.
But that's a nice thing to think about, like what Richard was saying, where the nomination is the reward. You know, if you're watching The Good Place and you've been like loving what Kristen Bell is doing, like, you know, she's probably not going to beat Julie Louis-Dreyfus, but you can root for her to get the nomination to get in there. Like, I felt that way about Glow and Betty Gilpin last year. There is this kind of cheerleading you can do for your favorite shows, because with the way that peak TV works, like, you can feel like you're the only person who's paying attention to the work this person's doing.
Right. Yeah. Remember when Tatiana Maslany won those nominations for Orphan Black, partly for that reason? Yeah.
Yeah. The internet campaign machine can work. Get your tweets going.
Okay. Hashtag Emmy for Alfie Allen. I'm starting it now.
Wait, is this your prediction that Theon's going to have a lot to do in this last season? Because I feel like we haven't seen much of him.
That's not a spoiler. That's just, I think, rewatching the entire series, I think Alfie Allen has been the most overlooked of a great performance in Game of Thrones.
Wait, Richard, since you've been doing your rewatch too, I'm going to know, who is the Game of Thrones person you want to see justly rewarded finally?
The actor who plays Olivar, the male prostitute.
he's rewarded in handsomeness.
I have to agree with Joanna on Lena Headey. I mean, she's been so the center of the show for so long and is giving a very nuanced performance. So, yeah, that would be exciting for her. And I feel like that she would be the only woman who's won from that show, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's just Peter Dinklage who's won.
It's only been Dinklage, in
the acting categories. Yeah.
Right.
She's
been
nominated, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think she gave like a really good, you know, like one of those all-time classic reaction shots to losing last year, I think it was. Just because she's great and has an amazing sense of humor. So the camera's on her. She's just sort of like, oh, darn, or whatever it was. I don't know.
Well, we're going to be talking about the Emmys a lot because, as I mentioned, we're kind of in a quieter period for movies. Emmys is really heating up. So we'll have a couple of weeks to talk about some of the shows that are out, talk to some of the people, get into some awards handicapping. So we can look forward to lots of obsessing about Emmys like that and maybe stumping for our personal Alfie Allens. But in the meantime, I think that does it for this week's episode. Sonia, thank you for coming in and joining us again.
Thanks for having me, guys.
So you can find all of us at VanityFair.com writing about things like the Emmys and Game of Thrones and Killing Eve and all kinds of other stuff. You can find us at Little Gold Men, where we tweeted the news this morning that we've been nominated for a Webby, which is pretty exciting. We are not above awards at all, as evidenced by the existence of this podcast. So vote for us. Please soothe our egos. You can find us all on Twitter on our own, too. I'm at Katie Rich, Joanna.
Jen wrote this.
And Richard.
Rylaws.
And Sonia.
Sonia Soraya.
This episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best embodiment of a TV critic during the era of peak TV goes to Sonia Soraya.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.